So we are in Parsha Shlach, and we're on Pasuk Das Zayin, where the Pasuk said that Moshe called Yehoshua ben Nun Yehoshua, and Rashi comments that the letter Yud represents Hashem's name, and this was a form of Moshe praying on behalf of Yehoshua that Hashem should save him from the plan of the spies. So the famous question is, why did Moshe daven for Yehoshua more than anyone else? So the Targum Yonah Siman Uziel says like this, Elain Shmahan Guvraya the Shadar Moshe Lalo Yasara. These are the names of the men that Moshe sent to spy out the land. Now, Uchdichama Moshe Invasanusei, and when Moshe saw, or Moshe realized, the humility of Yehoshua, of Hoshea, Kara Moshe Lohoshea Benun Yehoshua. That is when Moshe called Hoshea Yehoshua. Meaning, according to Yonah Siman Uziel, the reason why Moshe is praying for Yehoshua, meaning Yonah Siman Uziel doesn't speak out like Rashi, but we could explain Yonah Siman Uziel that Yonah Siman Uziel is following Rashi's approach, that the letter Yud was a form of praying for Yehoshua. By adding the letter Yud, he was praying on behalf of Hoshea. And why did he pray for Hoshea? He prayed for Hoshea because he saw Hoshea's humility. Which means, the same way Moshe is called Anuv Mikol Adam, the most humble of all men, his student, Hoshea, who we know was a student that never left his side, was also very humble. Moshe was concerned, though, that in Yehoshua's humility, he may buckle under the pressure of the other spies instead of standing up against them. And therefore, Moshe prayed on his behalf. He didn't need to pray for Kalev. He didn't need to pray for anybody else because anybody else didn't have this, so to speak, this worry about Hoshea, because Hoshea was very humble. He was extremely humble, and therefore Moshe was concerned that he may buckle under the pressure of his peers, and therefore he added the name Yud and prayed on his behalf. Now, in last week's Pasha, there is a very interesting. Comment that relates to this. And that is if you look back in Parshas Baloscha, here it is. It's Parshas Baloscha. It's Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Das Zayin. This is where Moshe was in last week's Parsha saying to Hashem that I can't carry the load of the Jewish people all alone. So what does Hashem say to him? Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. Hashem said to Moshe, Esfali Shivim Ish Mizikna Yisrael. Gather for me 70 men from the elders of Yisrael. Asher yadata, that you know, ki hem zikna Yisrael ba'am shaitrav, they are the elders of the nation and its officers. Lakachta oisam alo mayir v'tasu sham imach, and you shall take them to the Mishkan, and they will stand there with you. Okay, so now, these 70 men are called Shivim Ish. Ish is actually one, right? Even though we do find many times that when you have a group of people together, that they will be referred to in a singular form. It's not the first time. But when it does happen, very often there is a Midrashic interpretation to why the Torah uses that form. So there is a Midrash that says like this, Shivim Ish, 70 men. These 70 men were going to become leaders of the Jewish people alongside Moshe. And they had to have the attribute of Ish. Saying Shivim Ish was alluding to the fact that they had to have the attribute of Ish. There are two times, or maybe more than two times, but two times in the Torah that we have the word Ish that relates to leadership. What is V'ha'ish Moshe Anav Ma'od? The greatest leader of the Jewish people is called, we find the word Ish, and it says there, Vohaish Moshe Anav Ma'od. The man Moshe was very humble. So one trait that the 70 men, the 70 ish have to have is, they have to have the trait of her ish, Moshe Anav Ma'id. The man Moshe is very humble, they have to be very humble. But there's another word ish, that appears in a different part of the Torah, which the Torah wants to allude to here also, and that is Hashem Ish Milchama. Hashem is a man of war. Which means that the word ish is also used in the context that when you have to stand up and you have to fight for something, that you do so. The leaders have to have both traits. They have to be able to balance both traits. They should have the trait of Ish Moshe, of being humble, and they should also have the godly trait of Hashem Ish Melchama, Hashem is a man of war. Both have to be able to come together. You have to be humble, but humble doesn't mean that you're weak and you don't stand up for what's right. And therefore, but it seems here in this context, that actually Moshe saw in Yeshua the trait of humility that could actually be a trait that would overpower the Hashem Ish Melchama. It would overpower, it would be stronger than the trait of being the Ish Melchama, being the man of war, standing up and fighting for what's right. Therefore, as Yonos ben Uzziel says, Moshe Rabbeinu went ahead and added the letter, Moshe Rabbeinu changed his name because of that humility, which would mean he prayed on behalf of Yeshua to make sure that Yeshua's humility does not become a detriment to him. Now this idea that Moshe davened on behalf of Yeshua, that he should not be influenced and joined with the plan of the spies, actually touches on a very important philosophical question. And that is like this. We know the Gemara tells us, Hakol bidei shamayim, everything is in the hand of heaven, chutz miyira shamayim, except for the fear of heaven. Which means that Hashem does not determine whether we will be God-fearing or not. Hashem will determine whether we're wealthy, whether we're not wealthy, whether we are healthy, whether we're poor. Everything in life Hashem determines for us and controls, except he somehow, so to speak, when it comes to fear of God, when it comes to practicing what we call bechira, our ability to choose which direction we're going to go, that Hashem leaves up to us. And if that is the way it's supposed to be, what does it mean that Moshe davened on behalf of Yeshua that he shouldn't sin, that he shouldn't join up with the plan of the Meraglim? The question of sinning, or whether you're going to sin or not, that's not something that Hashem, so to speak, gets involved in. That's our choice. Somehow or another, Hashem leaves that up to us. And therefore, the question arises, what does it mean that Moshe davened on behalf of Yeshua that he should not stumble and be influenced by the spies? So the Ben Ish Chai, famous Sephardic sage, explains in the following way. He explains that there's two ways a person can sin. One way that a person can sin is that he's in a very clear state of mind. He knows what is right and what is wrong, and he chooses still to sin. That could either be, in my understanding, that could either be an act of rebelliousness, or not necessarily an act of rebelliousness. It could be that you have some kind of temptation, but at the same time, it's very clear to you what the situation is. It's very clear to you what's right and what's wrong, and somehow or another, you may still not be able to withstand the influence, the temptation, the pull of what's wrong. But you know what is right and what is wrong. But then there's another form of sinning, which is probably the more common form of sinning, which is where our Yetzer Hara, our evil inclination, convinces us that something that is wrong is right. Right? It's part of our nature. What?
It's part of our makeup.
Part of our nature, right? Part of who we are. That when we want to do something, we're going to justify it. And somehow or another, in our minds, we're going to justify that what is wrong is right. We become very unclear about what's right and what's wrong. So the Ben Ish Chai says that when we say Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyira shamayim, everything in the hands of Hashem except for fear of God, the fear of God somehow God just leaves up to us. That is when we reach that's where we're in a stage of clarity. That's we're in a stage of clarity, and we're in a state of clarity, and now it's up to us to make the decision of Tov or Ra. That is where we say that is there's no there. There, the Benish Chai says there's no point of davening there. That is up to us. But when the situation is where our natural makeup is confusing us, our Yetzirah is confusing us, that already is within the domain of Hashem. There you could go ahead and say to Hashem, give me clarity of thought. Because even though, again, we have to get beyond that confusion, we have to make sure that we remain clear of thought, and we have to make sure that we don't allow ourselves to convince ourselves that what is wrong is right. But that is something, again, it's part of our nature, it's something that flares up, and that is something that, like almost, like I guess you could say, the same way I say to Hashem, make me healthy, right? I have, when my physical nature goes awry, I can say to Hashem, heal me. So in this sense also, what that natural part of me, which is that I tend to try to justify what's wrong in order to do what I want to do, that's also something that I can turn to Hashem and say, help me with that. Help me be clear. Take that away. Help me have clarity. And therefore, when Moshe was, says the Ben Ishchai, when Moshe was davening for Yeshua, he was able to daven for Yeshua because Yeshua's test, or all the tests of the Meraglim, didn't boil down to the point of clarity, and still they're not doing it. There were things that were clouding their mind. There are many different commentaries, Perushim, about what is it exactly that turned the spies to do what they did? What made them go ahead and say that Hashem's not going to help us? What made them lose their trust and faith in Hashem when they saw these great, these giants and these fortified cities? They were great men, they were righteous. What was it that motivated them? So the Chafetz Chaim brings down a Zohar that says that deep down they were very concerned that when they entered Eretz Yisrael they would lose their positions of leadership. So they were influenced, right? They were influenced. There was something in their subconscious that was influencing them. There are a number of commentaries that explain what was it exactly that bothered the Jewish people. I'll give you another example that may relate to something else we're going to say later. The Chiddush HaArim says that the Jewish people, when they're about to enter Eretz Yisrael, were like a young man who got married. His father-in-law promised him, 5 years kest, 5 years support. He can learn for 5 years, but after 5 years, no more support, right? Comes at the end, so for the first 5 years, the man is he's in Gan Eden. He's sitting, he's learning, he has no financial woes. No financial worries. 5 years are up. What is he now? He has to leave the Beis Medrash. He has to leave that great state of spirituality that it was in. He's going into the world. He's got to support his family. The Jewish people in the desert, they had no worries. They had nothing that they needed to do. What did they do a whole time? They learned. Shlomo Feuerl Hirsch says they learned. They studied Torah a whole time.
They complained.
That's what they did. They complained too. Yeah. But the bottom line is, yeah, but you know what? If you look at, if you think about it, so all these parashiyos that talk about the problems were at the beginning of the 40 years. Mm. And then you don't hear any problems until the end of the 40 years. So you're talking about a very long period of time of a whole nation not doing anything wrong. But again, what were they involved with? What did they keep themselves busy with? They were studying Torah. But they understood that when they entered Eretz Yisrael, that was over. They were going to be living in the land, and they're going to be working in the land. There's no more mun, there's no more slav, there's no more rock. Now they have to go ahead and actually leave that world of complete spiritual involvement and now get down to getting into the world. That frightened them. It frightened them, said the Chiddush HaArim. And therefore that blurred their vision, that blurred their perspective, and they weren't able to see things the way they should. But again, according to in what we're talking about now, the Jewish people are really in a certain stage of not necessarily. Maybe you look in Rashi. Rashi says that they did doubt Hashem, But we could say that really it was all, they were not in a state of clarity. They were in a state of confusion. There was a situation, different things were motivating them to see things in a way that they shouldn't have seen things. And therefore, that was the second form of sinning. That's the form of sinning when the Yetzer Hara is blurring your perception. When you don't think clearly, when you don't see things clearly. If that was the kind of sin we're talking about, says the Ben Ish Chai, that is what Moshe was able to pray for. Moshe was able to pray that Yoshua not be convinced, not fall into the trap of his colleagues, and allowing the Yetzer Hara to influence them and convince them that what they were doing was right. But rather, Hashem should give him the clarity of thought to be in a state of clarity, and then at that point, they're left to make the decision that they have to make. So that's how the Ben Ish Chai learns how it was possible for Moshe to pray for Yeshua, that Yeshua should not fall into sinning like his colleagues. Even though we have a rule that your decisions for right and wrong, it's Hakobi De Shemayim Chutz Bi Yerushamayim, that is, as we say, completely in our hands. The Ben Ish Chai says that's in a state of clarity of thought. And that's what Moshe wanted, prayed on behalf of Yeshua. Once we're in that state of clarity of thought, that's already the point where now it's all in our hands. You know, there's also a famous question. I mean, this actually would touch on, I mean, it's the same question. You know, I want them to saw a discussion about, you know, can you daven for someone else to do tshuva? I mean, tshuva is HaKol B'Dei Shemayim Chutz Mi Reshemayim. Tshuva is a part of your free will, and your free will is something that's up to you. And therefore, can you daven for someone else to do tshuva? Well, according to this Ben Ish Chai, you could. Because the point of davening first into tshuva is that he should come to a state of clarity of thought. The Rebbeinu Shlomo should give him an opportunity to have clarity of thought to then see things in the right light and make the right decision. The Beis Halevi says that, you know, there's the big discussion about when it says Hashem hardened the heart of Paro when the plagues were coming. Hashem hardened Paro's heart. All the commentaries ask, that means he's taking away Paro's free will. So the Beis Halevi says, no. Beis Halevi says, hardening Paro's heart was to make sure that Paro shouldn't just give in right away to the plagues. Because Hashem wanted Paro to actually have Bechira. He wanted Paro to have the choice. And if there is that pressure of all the plagues, of course he's going to give in. Hardening Paro's heart is what brings Paro back to a state of not being pressured by the suffering. The suffering, the effect of what the suffering would normally have, that Hashem took away. And now Paro is left in a state of choice. You know, he sees everything around him, he knows everything around him, but it's without that pressure. So that Paro would make the actual choice on his own. And each time, Paro made the choice on his own not to listen to Hashem.
So why is not having clarity of thought instead of sinning?
Because you're obligated to be aware of yourself and not allow yourself to be fooled.
They must have been doing the best they could.
Apparently not. Apparently, it was expecting more of them. One of the things that we say vidui on is we say al chay shachanu lefanecha b'yetzer hara, and we sin before you with the Yetzer Hara. And one of the explanations are is that we allow the Yetzer Hara to convince us that what is right, what is wrong is right. It's part of our nature that we talk ourselves into things. But we're responsible to try to keep that clarity of thought and have that introspection to think and say to ourselves, are we really being sincere? Are we talking it into ourselves? Are we talking ourselves into this because we really want it? That's our responsibility. And that would be saying that the spies didn't do that well enough.
Maybe it's not having self-discipline.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, okay. That would be the source of the sin. Okay.
They lost their amuno.
At the end of the day, that's what it was. Because if they're doubting that Hashem can help them,
fight those giants. And,
at the end of the day, that's how it manifests itself, right?
Right.
Okay.
Isn't that they were afraid of now, we're going there, we have to do the right thing on our own.
That could be, but at the end of the day, the way they said that was, is that we can't conquer the world. That's how they said it at the end.
they were afraid that without Hashem's help,
what made them think that they're not going to have Hashem's help?
They have to do it themselves.
What made it? What they have to do? What? Hashem said they're going to be able to conquer their enemies.
Yeah, but they're going to have to work the field. They're going to have to.
Okay,
do
so the point to the point to the point.
Don't have to do it.
But now, at the end of the day,
maybe.
But
maybe
at the end of
the time, when, let me say, maybe the time, maybe we won't be worthy. That Hashem shall help that we
at
have.
The end of the day, but at the end of the day, their question, what they never said, we don't want to work the land, we're afraid to work the land. They said Hashem is not going to help it. We're not going to be able to conquer the land.
That's what I mean, because they did something. You know, that's maybe they're doing something wrong.
Okay. Let's now go to Perek Gimel Pasuk Lamed Beis.
Verse 32.
Yeah. Page 802. Page 802.
About 8 lines down.
Okay. This is already after the spies return, and they've already started giving the bad report. And they brought out the slander of the land, Ashataru Isa, which they spied out, Al Bnei Yisrael Lamar, to the Jewish people, saying, Haaretz, the land, Asharavar Nuva, that we have crossed into it, Lasar Isa, to spy it, Eretz Oichelet Yeshverahi, it is a land that devours its inhabitants. The Chalama Shereinu B'Seicha, and all the nation that we saw in it, Anshe Midais, are very large people. So they describe the land as a land that devours its inhabitants. What does that mean? So Rashi comments, "B'chol makim she'avarnu, wherever we went, mitzanum kovrei mesim, we found them burying people. Everywhere we went, there were funerals. People were dying, and there were funerals going on. V'akadosh baruch hu asel ataiva, the Rabbeinu shel Olam did it for their good. K'dei latardam be'evlam, in order to keep them busy with their mourning." For the Yitnu Lev La'elu, and they won't pay attention to these people. So they encountered a very strange thing, that wherever they went, people were involved in funerals. And to them, they look at that and they say, this is a pretty dangerous place. All these people are dropping like flies. There must be something wrong with this land. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, though, did it in order to keep the Canaanites busy so as not to notice them. You know, when in the beginning of the book of Yeshua, where Yeshua sends two spies into the land, into the city of Yericho. Second chapter of Yeshua. So these two spies, these two Israelites come in, and boom, right away they're looking for them. Right away the king goes looking for them. Meaning they walk in there and they're noticed. They're like, who are these people?
There's two Jews.
Who are these two Jews? Jews doing over here? Jews are trouble. What? Right, thank you. That's right. So these people could have very. You see from there, right? That these people, wherever they went, could have been very well noticed, you know. And it wasn't. Didn't happen, and it didn't happen because of the fact they were so busy with their funerals. So what the spies should have seen as a favor for them, they actually saw it in a negative light. Now, I saw a Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky gives a parable to kind of bring out what happens here. He says there was this shoe business that decided to try to open a market in Africa, and many years ago, and they sent out two salesmen. Two people to go out and look to see if they could establish, you know, to establish businesses in Africa to sell shoes there. So they're there for a week, and one salesman reports back to the shoe company in America, and he says, this is a waste of time. We'll never sell shoes here. They all walk around barefoot. So there's no point of selling shoes here. The other guy sends a message to the business and says, hey, this is a gold mine. No one has shoes here. You can look at the same thing, and you can look at it, you know, half empty, half full. And in essence, what was happening here was, something was happening here, which could be seen positive, could be seen negative. And the spies took it as negative instead of positive. Okay. So, the Berachas Peretz points out that this was not just merely a question of, you know, half full, half empty. Really, if there was an interest on the point of the spies to see the good, they should have seen the good. And that was because, you know, if seeing all these funerals is because this is a dangerous land, then that would mean these are not the first funerals to take place. This should be happening pretty often. And if these things happen pretty often, then the people shouldn't be so consumed with funerals that they can't notice these strangers. That we know later on were very noticeable. If the land is so dangerous, and that's why these people are dying, then this is not the first funeral to happen. This should be a common occurrence. And if it's a common occurrence, maybe the local maybe the family is upset, but people start taking these things for granted.
Things go on.
Right, and therefore they should have gone ahead. And if that's what was happening, they shouldn't have gone unnoticed. It should have been something that they should have realized. Why are we going unnoticed? Why is it that these people are so consumed with the funerals that they can't see us? If it's because of the fact that this is a dangerous land, then this is not the first funeral. This should be happening. This is commonplace. And if it's commonplace, they shouldn't be so consumed not to notice us. And therefore, there was actually more reason to realize that this was a kindness. And they still didn't do so. And that's a deeper understanding of when Rashi says that they interpreted what was going on as this is a very dangerous place. What they should have seen was that this is really a kindness, a favor from Hashem to have them going unnoticed by what was happening. Okay. Let's now go towards actually the end of the parsha. No, actually before we do that, I want to mention something else here. Very interesting thought. Look back in Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Chaf Beis. Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Chaf Beis.
Right after Shady.
Yeah, the second pasuk after Shady.
800, five lines down.
Okay. So this is the point where Moshe has given the spies their mission, and it says that they went to spy the land. Vayalu Banegev. They went up in the south. Vayavoy ad Chevron. Literally translated would be, and he came to Chevron. It's Vayalu is in plural form. Then the pasuk changes to Vayavoy, and he came, which is singular form. So Rashi comments, Vayavoy ad Chevron, and he came to Chevron. Who is the one person we're talking about Chevron here? Kalev, Levadei Halachsham. Kalev alone went to Chevron. Nishtateach HaKivrei Avos, and he prayed by the graves of the forefathers. By Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. Shol Yehinisas L'Chaveirav L'Yeis Batzasam. They should not become convinced to join up with his friends in their plan against Eretz Yisrael. Okay. And Rashi says because of that, he was actually given Chevron as his place, as a gift to him when they divided up the land. Okay. So, there is a common practice that people go and pray by the graves of tzaddikim, right? Very common practice. People daven by the graves of tzaddikim. And this is actually, you know, the first time we see it, right? This idea of actually going to pray at the grave of a righteous person. So, Rabbi Yisrael Reisman brings the Drushas Haran that explains this practice in a very interesting way. And again, we have to turn back to Parashas Baal Yischa, actually where we were before, which is Perek Yud Aleph. And this is Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Yeah. So, Hashem tells Moshe, gather 70 people, okay, bring them to the Mishkan, and they shall stand there with you. V'yaradati v'dibarti mechasham, I shall come down, I shall speak with you there. V'atzalti min haruach asher alecha v'samti aleihem. And I will then, how do they translate the word v'atzalti? I will increase.
I will descend and I will increase.
Okay. And I will increase from the spirit that is on you, and I shall place it upon them. So this basically it means, I think the way Rashi explains it is, the way I explained it is Moshe, for sure what's happening here is the Nevuah, the prophecy is starting on Moshe and then spreading to the rest of them. So the Drash HaSaran, the way he explains this Pasuk, the way he explains this process is that the 70 people who would now become the leaders of Moshe were really not worthy of prophecy. But once Moshe would get the prophecy, the Kedusha, the sanctity, the prophecy from Moshe would spread. There is a the Drash HaSaran says Kedusha spreads. And therefore, when the Kedusha, with the sanctity of Nebuah rested upon Moshe, it would now be able to spread from Moshe onto them. They couldn't get it directly. They'd have to get it by being connected to Moshe, by being together with Moshe. And with that connection to Moshe, if I understand the Drash HaSaran correctly, the nature of the Nebuah would be now to spread, because Kedusha spreads. You know, we find a concept on the opposite. Tumah, right? Impurity can spread. If you're in the oil of a mace, you're under the same roof as a mace, and you don't touch the mace, what happens? The tumah spreads. Tumah can spread. The Drash HaSaran says Kedusha also spreads. And in this, and the way it worked here is that these 70 people were given this connection with Moshe, that now the Kedusha, the sanctity of Nevuah that rests on Moshe, can now spread to them. But the Drash HaSaran seems to be saying that this is the nature. This is the nature of Kedusha, is that it spreads. And I would add, the way I understand it is, and for you to be able to get that Kedusha that's spreading, there are certain conditions that have to be met. You know, not just because not every time that you're near Kedusha is Kedusha going to spread on you, or maybe to some degree it will. In this case, for the Kedusha, for the Nevuah to spread, because of the nature of Kedusha to spread, in this context, where Nevuah is going to spread from Moshe onto these people, there was this special connection these people had with Moshe, a special merit that these people had. But the way the process was, Kedusha spreads, and therefore sanctity spreads, and therefore the Nevuah that came to Moshe would spread to these people. It does. That's not the Atzalti. The Atzalti, again, my goodness, first of all, I'm not sure. I'm not going to say for sure that the Ran is learning about Atzalti is how it will increase. But even if you do, but even so, the understanding of Atzalti, excuse me, is that Moshe would have a prophecy, and then Hashem would increase the prophecy that it can now spread to the others.
Yeah, the ability to prophesy.
Yeah. To have that prophetic experience at that point of time. But v'atzalti min haruach, that's wherever it's, I will, from the spirit that's on you, it's starting through Moshe, it's going through Moshe. And another example that the Drash HaSaran gives is, again, at the end of Parshas Baal Yischa, which is after Miriam and Aaron speak against Moshe. So the Pasuk says that Hashem... This is Perek Yud Beis, chapter 12, Pasuk Dal, verse 4. Vayomer Hashem Pisaim El Moshe Vel Aaron Vel Miriam. Suddenly Hashem said to Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, Tzu shloshtechem alayam layed. All three of you go to the Mishkan. Vayet tzu shloshtem, they all went. Vayemid Hashem ba'amud anan, vayamid pesach ha'oyel. And Hashem came down in a pillar of cloud, and he stood by the opening of the Mishkan, vayikra Aaron and Miriam, and he called to Aaron and Miriam, vayet tzu shnem, and they both went out. So first Hashem says, all three of you come together, and then Hashem calls those two. Why didn't just call those two? Why does he have to call all three together? So the Ran explains, because this is happening in the middle of the day. This is happening in broad daylight. Aaron and Miriam aren't on the level of prophecy to be able to have prophecy like that, to have sudden prophecy.
In daytime,
they usually was done in nighttime and in a dream. They were not on the level of prophecy like Moshe that they could experience this. In order for them to experience, they first had to be together with Moshe. And once the Nevuah came onto Moshe, it could now spread onto them. Now the Ran takes his concept into this week's parsha. When the Pasuk says, Vayavoy at Chevron, that he came to Chevron, the Rashi says, Kalev went to Chevron to daven by Moras and Machpelah. He went to daven by the graves of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. The Drashas Aran explains that davening by the grave of a tzaddik works the same way. The kedusha, the sanctity of a tzaddik, spreads. Your connection to a tzaddik is automatically beneficial by just being in his vicinity, because the kedusha of the tzaddik spreads. And when you try to connect to the tzaddik and you try to have a connection with him, you can now retain from the, you can now absorb some of that kedusha. You can now retain some of that kedusha. But the kedusha, the sanctity of the righteous individual, spreads. And it spreads not only when he's alive, it spreads even after death. And where the tzaddik's body resides, he is still giving off kedusha. Kedusha is still emanating from him. And therefore, the place of the burial of the tzaddik is a very special place to daven, because it's in this vicinity that his kedusha is emanating, his kedusha is spreading to all those who are in his vicinity, and therefore it becomes a special place for davening. So Kalev understood this concept. That's why he went, and this is where we're introduced to the concept of davening by the graves of the righteous, because the tzaddik's kedusha is always spreading even after his death. And where his place is after his death is the place where he's buried. There, his kedusha is still emanating and spreading. And therefore, it's there that we go to be influenced by that sanctity and to daven there as a place where Hashem accepts our prayers more than in other places. Okay.
Churches like in France and Paris, you can't really walk anywhere without walking on a grave.
Yeah.
Because they bury the people in the church.
No. What's that got to do with us?
Well, if I extend your concept, maybe we should do something like that here, because then our prayers will.
No. Every place has its unique. Has its unique characteristic. There's a shul, there's a place for the tzaddikim, each one has its spot. Do you know that there are people who daven sometimes, there are people by a yard site of a tzaddik that will daven at his grave. There are people who daven in Meiron and in Maris HaMachpelah every day. They have that setup, even though they don't have exactly that setup. I mean,
they have a room.
They have places, I'm saying. It's that's also davening in the place of tzaddikim.
No,
because then the Kohanim are going to have problems. There's two things. Like I say, every place has its place. Everything has its proper place.
I was at Shlomo Kalibach's kever once for his yahrzeit, and there was a whole crowd of people, and they didn't. When all of a sudden they signed for mincha, they didn't leave.
I'm saying there are situations, there are times. I mean, again, I don't know if people do it regularly, but I'm saying that by yard sites they do it. I mean, I have seen it being done.
They go to the oil and they say Tillam.
I'm saying, but I'm talking about davening now. I mean, yeah. Saying Tillam is a different story. But like, you know, to daven a regular davening there in Talis Tefillin, you know, in Meiron they do it all the time. In Maras and Nachri they do it all the time. But typically, people don't go doing that, in regular cemeteries, except on in special cases and special days.
Especially,
I mean, you got this right. You know, by that this villa does it Erev Yom Kippur. In Everett. I don't think it's an unusual practice. I think there are people who do that.
They usually when they go to daven, let's say after a funeral, like daven mincha, they go into one of one of the houses there that they used to use for. They did at the Harris there. I'm not sure.
Not necessarily, but. I mean, again, it is interesting that it is not very commonplace to actually do a regular tefillah at the Kever of a Tzaddik. That's not the usual way it's done, as Martin's pointing out. Typically, you know, with people daven in a shul, as special as a Kever Tzaddikim are, the place we daven is in a shul. Okay, let me just conclude with a thought at the end of the parsha. The last pasuk in the parsha, which is the last verse of Shema that we say, which would be what page you got there?
818.
Page 818. Perek Tesvav pasuk Mem Aleph. Right, this is the last pasuk that we say in the last pasuk of Shema. Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem your God. Asher Yitzeisi Etzchem Eretz Mitzrayim, I took you out from the land of Egypt. The Yais Lachem Elokim to be for you as a God, and the Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem your God. Why does it say twice? Right, it says in the beginning of the pasuk, and the Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem your God. And then again, it concludes, and the Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem your God. Why are you saying it twice? So Rav Shimon Schwab Zatzal gave the following explanation. And that is that. We find ourselves serving Hashem under, in we can divide it into two general categories. We serve Hashem sometimes in a state of Gilui Hashchina, of when the divine presence of Hashem is revealed. And then there are times that we serve Hashem in Hester Panim, when Hashem's face is hidden. We have good times, we have bad times. We have times that when Hashem is clear, and we have times when we have a situation where we wonder where is Hashem. But in each one of those situations, we are obligated, we serve Hashem. So therefore, the two Ani Hashem Elokeichems that are being mentioned here are referring to both those states of being. The first, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I'm Hashem, we got to take you out of Egypt. When Hashem took us out of Egypt, that was Gilui Hashchina. That was a state of, when it was clear the Shekhinah, Hashem did miracles, the Jewish people, was very clear to them that Hashem was with them. And then again, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem your God. That even when we're not in that state, even when things don't appear too hot, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem your God. I am there with you. You may not see me, I'm there with you. And we serve Hashem under all those circumstances. And we know that in davening, when we say this, so we say Ani Hashem Elokeichem. We say Hashem Ani Hashem Elokeichem, right? And we actually add the word Emes, right? Emes is actually the beginning of the next bracha, right? And it's the beginning of the bracha that follows Shema, right? We put it together, and that's the halacha. The halacha is we're not supposed to split up Ani Hashem Elokeichem and Emes. They're supposed to always go together. So Rav Schwab explains it like this. Being that the second Ani Hashem Elokeichem is I am Hashem your God, even in the times when you don't see me, and we are committing ourselves to serve Hashem even in that state of being, and understandably that's a difficult situation to do that in, so we say Ani Hashem Elokeichem Emes V'yatzev Anochem. That's the truth. That's Yatzev Anochem, Mekayim V'Yasho. We go through all those descriptive words of talking about how that last verse, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem your God, is the absolute truth. But we do, and we do that, says Reb Schwab, because we're connecting that to the last part. The last part of Ani Hashem Elokeichem, where it's talking about Hashem says, I am your God even in the dark times, and we're committing ourselves to serving Hashem in those dark times. We say, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem your God. Emes, that's the truth. As hard as it may be to realize and to see, it is the emes. It's the absolute, absolute truth. And therefore, we make sure to say emes together, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, and halachically, we're not allowed to split it up.
Not allowed to.